Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, today's Friday. It's April 8th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And I noticed that already our first guest and only guest today is New York State Assembly member Nader Sage. And he's on the line right now. Good morning. Good morning, Assembly member. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. Always a pleasure. It's a good day. It's a Friday. And,
yes,
you know, we're busy at work with the state budget and hopefully good results.
Well, that's really very encouraging. You know, there's always pushback. You know, there always seems to be like another side of the equation. So why do we hear such a stir all of a sudden? Isn't there always, a challenge to meet the deadlines that are set? But there are also circumstances that cause things to be delayed. So what's the holdup, and why does it matter if we don't approve the budget by today or yesterday or a week from today? What's the difference? I don't get it.
Well, you know, there's a time frame where the expectation by April 1st of each year, the state should have a budget plan. But the reality is in a state like New York or any political situation, you know, politics to a large extent plays a role. The importance of, how you partition the budget. I mean, mind you, anytime the budget discussions, you have a certain amount of funds that are available, for example. And when you put a budget together and you have 150 assembly members and senators and the governor's office and constituents and lobby groups from every angle of the state representing practically every, you know, business, every industry, every sector of the community, you know, a lot of lobbying goes on and people, protest and demand that the bigger share of the pie goes to their cause or their needs. And, you know, and that's the process. Very often, you know, the needs could be there and there's a lot of justification, but you're in a position as a government official to really review the budget, review all the concerns, the needs, and try to partition that amount of money in a way that really is fair and equitable. And very often it doesn't happen right away. And very often there's policy decisions that are sometimes placed in the budget, like in bail reform and other issues. And people may have issues with that, and people may debate, what the final outcome of these legislative issues and pieces are. So very often,
and I love that word that you use, partition. How does one partition to satisfy one side of the equation, a second side to the equation? There might even be a third and a fourth side. And how do you balance it out so that everybody goes away with a little bit of food here? You know, it's like one meal, and we got to divide the food, and some going to get a little less, and some going to get a little bit more.
Correct.
So is it always going to be a win? Will it be the Republicans or the Democrats, or will it be the Democrats or the Republicans? Which way do you go?
But you're right, Hezzy. I don't know how you do it. Yeah, well, one way to look at it, you know, you have this pie, and everybody wants a piece of the pie, and sometimes some groups out there want a big piece of the pie, which means there isn't a lot left for everyone else. So, you know, I, as a legislator, look at, you know, major components that impact us as a society, as a community, the economy. You know, education is one of them. So when you look at that pie, you know, part of my goal is how do we get a good slice of that pie to go to public education, to go to higher education? For example, this year, you know, and last year, there was a good piece of the pie went to education, you know, pre-K to 12, early childhood, And a lot of funds also were increased in this budget for the state and the city university, for SUNY and CUNY. A lot of New Yorkers utilize that system. It's a terrific system of higher education that really affords a lot of families an opportunity where the tuition is reasonable. There's a lot of tuition assistance programs, opportunities for all children, no matter what their economic status, to go to school, get a decent education, and really build up careers and, you know, and have a meaningful life. That's what we as legislators, you as a media person, society in general, is what do we do to make quality of life more efficient, better for all of us, you know, those that can afford and those that can't afford, and making sure that with an avenue for opportunity, that, you know, society would be a better place, our community would be a better place. So with this budget, you know, we agreed last year, and the governor went on board and said, you know, let's restore foundation aid to public schools, and school districts like Yonkers and all across the state got their share of funding that was taken away years ago by the state to balance their budget. And, you know, we reinforced it with higher education, with SUNY and CUNY. If you recall, years ago when I went to college, most of the professors were full-time professors. And that was great, having a full-time professor that committed his or her time 100% to students and their needs and research and so forth. You know, over the years, to address economic concerns, colleges started hiring predominantly what they call adjunct professors. These are people that course or two, a few courses, they have no benefits, no seniority, they're not paid a lot, and they usually have other careers, other professions. So they don't have the time to follow up students and get involved with research and really mentor the students, you know, in a proper way. So I believe that over the years, higher education has taken a hit here in the USA, you know, as compared to many other countries across the world. So with this increase in funding for SUNY and CUNY, we took into consideration, you know, the necessary funds where these colleges will start restoring full-time professorships. And I think that's a win-win. So from the educational perspective, I was happy with this budget. I think, you know, it comes out to some $220, possibly up to $221 billion. This is the state budget. A lot of people look at it and say, that's a lot of money. It is a lot of money. And I think, you know, with enhanced revenue from sport betting, enhanced revenue from the downstate licensing we'll talk about that is forthcoming, And also additional taxation is such where we have more money to play with. The pie is a little bit bigger. Again, there's a lot of people lobbying for a bigger piece of the pie. And I think the last month, there's been a tremendous amount of back and forth and negotiations. But to a large extent, I believe, you know, we're at a good place. Not everybody has exactly what they want. It's a give and take, but at the end of the day, you know, you have to kind of compromise or sometimes force people to compromise and say, look, you know, you can't have everything you want, and I can't have everything I want, and the city of Yonkers can't have everything, and Buffalo can't, and every part of the state can't. But you know what? We as legislators got to look not only at the best interest in my case of my city of Yonkers, but we got to, to some extent, think about the rest of the state. You got to think about upstate New York, western New York, the needs of New York City, the mid-Hudson where we are in Yonkers. And it takes that inspiration, that collaboration, and yes, the lobbying and the extensive efforts to kind of convince the leadership in Albany, from the speaker to the majority leader to the governor and their staff, that, hey, you know, my needs are more important than somebody else's needs. And at the end of the day,
I got to ask you, though, that based on that perspective, it seems like the entire assembly, the New York State Assembly, they're like on a different plane than the public or the advocates of one perspective or another. What makes you guys so magnanimous with one another? Or is it just an understanding of there's got to be a balance? And why is it that the advocates of particular perspectives don't appreciate that, yeah, you got to worry about upstate New York, and you've got to worry about New York City, and you've got to worry about Buffalo or Yonkers or Dobbs Ferry, all these places?
Sure.
Why is there a difference? Where's the disconnect? And so are we constantly going to be fighting? Because there never seems to be a peace. You know, like just a little bit of respite here would be nice.
But sometimes, you know, you're right. Sometimes there is a fight, and sometimes, you know, it starts pretty bitter, and you have different elements,
yeah,
at different sides that, you know, want what they want, and sometimes it comes across early as, hey, you know, this is my need, this is my constituents, and, you know, I got to deliver it to them. I really don't care what happens in Yonkers or what happens in Buffalo or upstate or western New York. And that's a wrong attitude. I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier the politics and the lobbying that takes place between Democrats and Republicans. You're right. I mean, that's a major play. But also the last number of years, you know, since the Democrat Party has had a, what I consider a superior majority in the assembly, of course, the governor is a Democrat and the majority of the Senate is Democrats. You know, so the Democrats, we're in a good position. But then you got to realize the lobbying between Democrats themselves and the, sometimes the division that occurs between, you know, Democrats that are moderate and Democrats that even consider themselves socialists, that's how far left they may be. And then you look at the region. You got the New York City, you know, representatives that are lobbying largely for city programs and services, and many of them don't impact, you know, outside New York City. So, you know, the fight is, you know, how do you balance for Democrats that represent upstate New York? I mean, the economies of upstate New York is crucial for them. Farming is very crucial for upstate New York. So the legislators that are representing western and upstate New York, they're lobbying hard to make sure that, you know, and they've been losing enrollment. People have been moving out. The economy sometimes is not very good and shambles. So they're focusing on making sure some of that pie goes to incentives to help farmers and help the industries in upstate, the wine industry, the cheese industry, the maple syrup industry. I mean, there's many industries in New York that, you know, the economy of the local economy relies on things.
Absolutely. So, and but is there a disconnect then from the government? On the one hand, the people who represent the different communities in government, and the public, do we understand, or are we comfortable? You know, like, are people in Yonkers comfortable? Are people in Buffalo comfortable? Are people up in Oneonta comfortable, or out in Long Island? Are they comfortable with the outcomes, or is there constant disarray and a slugfest? Because you know, the language is sometimes so high-pitched, it's as if we don't really respect one another. And yet somehow you guys balance it out. So how come we don't get it as a public?
It's easy. Trust me, it's not easy, and there's a lot of sometimes there's a lot of anger, and, you know, there's a lot of hurt feelings. But, you know, the process is such where, you know, you really got to be steadfast. You got to keep your cool. You got to recognize that, look, you know, at the beginning of any negotiation, in any business, any negotiation, everyone starts off with high, you know, asking for what they want the most. And then everybody has a backup plan. Well, I want A, and A is everything I want, but I got to realize you know, at some point I got to compromise. So what's my B plan? And a B plan is where normally, you know, you figure if I give and take, that's where I want to be. And a C plan is really where, hey, I can't live with this and my community can't live with this and I'm going to fight like hell to make sure, you know, at the end of the day, the budget is in a C for me in my region or my city and whatever. So I think at the end of the day, when negotiation starts, everybody wants their A. And I think this budget is such where, you know, in most cases, people got the B. And when you get to the B level, most people say, hey, you know what? I fought for so
that's
much
so
more. But, you know, at the end of the day, I got my fair share of the pie. And that's where we are today. For example, upstate is happy. Middle class is happy. There's a tremendous amount of, you know, reductions in taxes. I myself, you know, we fought hard to make sure that New Yorkers, especially here in my community, you know, homeowners, business owners, that there was tax credits. There was at least some relief, you know, in taxation. You know, New Yorkers were one of the highest tax people, and that was for me a very crucial issue because, you know, we've seen last year 300,000 people leave our state. You know, people blame the pandemic. They blame the economy. They blame, you know, high taxation, crime. There's a lot of reasons that people give up on a state, on a community, and say, you know what, I've had enough. I'm moving out. And from our end as legislators, you got to be concerned. You got to say, hey, you know, we got to stop this trend. We lost the congressional seat the last decade, and before that, we were
I got to ask you about that. Isn't a lot of the stuff like people leave New York while they're in their formative years, you know, as adults and employed, they stay here because you can really make a good living in New York State. But then it's time to retire, and many people retire to Florida where they save a lot of money and other communities where it's less expensive. Is this how we lose some of our population? Not everything.
But that's a good point. I mean, you're right. Many older people, you know, that leave to retire in the warmer weather and whatever. But that's the norm, Hezzy. You know, our problem, you know, what has taken place, the norm, you know, our concern isn't, you know, the seniors that are leaving because of warm weather and retirement. Our problem is young people that grew up in New York, that, you know, went to school in New York and now they're ready to settle down and accept jobs. They can't afford a house. They can't afford New York because of taxation and the high cost. Mm-hmm. That's who we're losing. That's
where we're losing. Okay.
Stay here. That's the difference than the seniors that are leaving for, you know, the historical or reasonable reasons of retirement and pensions and warm weather and so forth. That's the concern that's, you know, driving us, you know, to address
how is it the government balances out all these needs? And also, besides the financial hardship that citizens and residents have to endure, how do we balance also the lack of opportunity or people of who differentiate themselves one way or the other, or are differentiated because of color, because of ethnicity, because of gender, because of a million and one reasons. How do you balance that out? Because society is in disarray over it, but
you're right.
The government is a lot more balanced about it, it seems.
Well, you're right. That's why we spoke earlier about, you know, in my opinion, the biggest avenue, the biggest door to open for fair opportunity and really equality and really, in my opinion, resolving some of the injustice that we have as a society in many fashions is real education. That's why I've always been an advocate for making sure from the pre-K to high school level and college level, we spoke about the need to enhance public educational funding to address especially in Yonkers and many urban communities, you know, large students of color population, where in the past, because of inefficient programs, after school, tutoring programs, support services, full day pre-K, universal pre-K, these are programs that, you know, in many communities were cut or reduced,
yeah.
And therefore students weren't given the full opportunity to maximize their learning. That's why, as a former educator, as a Board of Ed president, you know, I was also the president of the
Principal.
Big Five school district in New York. We took a very active role to continue to say, you know, fix the way we fund education, make sure that especially urban school districts with large percentages of English language learners, special ed students, you know, that they get the services they need. They get the funding they need so they can get a quality education. And to me, you know, even extending that to higher education, like we spoke earlier, I'm very happy with this budget, the enhances or the increase for SUNY, the City University of New York, and also State University, SUNY, and CUNY, the City University, where they got so much more funding, and we enhanced tuition assistant programs.
But
do people
realize that with more funding to SUNY and CUNY, do they realize that what you put into the budget is advancement or potential advancement of people who, you know, engage in education and decide to become the student population? And they have an opportunity financially to afford it.
You know, so when you look at the diversification.
Does that translate to the public, to the voter? Do they get it?
The public should know. When you look at, you know, individuals from all ethnic and racial backgrounds the last 30, 40 years that have become successful and become lawyers and judges and doctors and Supreme Court justices, many of them, you look, you know, were educated in the state and city university. And they'll attribute to that opportunity. And many of the students that have been really tormented with, you know, the high student loans, you know, the government again has extended and waived, you know, the interest rates on them. And I've been lobbying hard to make sure that when a person works hard and, you know, they're forced to take out loans for their education and, you know, and they stop their careers and already they're like $200,000 to $500,000 in debt because of loans and they can't afford proper housing. You know, they can't even get married. They can't even establish a family. And these type of restrictions is what we as a society should be looking at. You know, we've always been a nation that promotes education, promotes career success, you know, but when our young generation are saying to us, hey, I went to school, I went to medical school, to law school, I have $500,000 in debt, they're taxing me 50% of my salary, I can't get out of this, I can't even survive, I can't even afford a home in New York State. So they end up moving out. You know, we educated this young generation, so that's our problem. So that's why we're fighting to make sure that, you know, we extend many opportunities for tuition assistance, that we try to help many graduates with loans and to make sure that if they can't be forgiven, at least, you know, we avoid the additional interest on them and try to keep it reasonable. We make sure that we have services where if somebody has an issue with housing, if somebody affords a house, that we keep taxation at a low point so that we can keep this generation right here in New York. So I think with this budget, there's been a lot of emphasis on middle-class tax cuts. There's been credits for education, for child care. That's another area. You know, we want people to go back to work, but if someone is raising a family and they have younger kids and they can't afford child care, then, you know, then it's difficult, you know. So that's where government should focus on the needs of seniors and making sure nursing homes are safe and making sure that education is sound, making sure that healthcare and hospitals all across. Here in Yonkers, you know, when I speak to representatives from St. John's and St. Joseph's Hospital that impact Yonkers,
yeah.
you know, they cry out, you know, that, you know, they feel they're serving a disadvantaged population. They're having trouble, you know, financially because of the high cost of health care, because to provide proper health care, you need the proper funding. So if they don't get proper funding or reimbursement for the services they provide, then it causes a gap. And we have these gaps. I've worked hard to provide full funding for the hospitals to address some of their needs. We fought hard as a member of the State Assembly Healthcare Committee to make sure that there was funding in this budget for depressed hospitals, inner city hospitals, so that the maternity care units and the emergency rooms and other services have the funding so that at the very least when your children or your spouse or your relatives or parents go to the ER, that there's adequate health care, there's adequate backup support.
Well, you bring up a really important point, and that is, can we be equal in government in affording a particular percentage of support for, let's say, a downstate hospital as opposed to an upstate hospital, and everything in between? In a balanced way, should there be one equation that meets the demands, let's say, of a city like Yonkers as it meets the demands of Oneonta or Buffalo or Ithaca, New York? How is it that, you know, like, for example, when we get reimbursement for investments in schools, we get one percentage, another community may get another percentage, and it makes it easier for them to build a new school, whereas we can't afford to build a new school because it costs us too much money, you know, to pay for the difference. Besides,
you're right.
Besides the funding. So why isn't it the same, or can it not be the same? That's the issue.
Well,
why
no,
is it different in Buffalo than it is in New York or Syracuse or Rochester?
No,
I don't get it.
You're right. As in any field, you got to make sure that whether it's education or healthcare or other fields, that there's a certain standard that is acceptable, that is reasonable, that, for example, in education, you want to make sure that every child gets a fair and quality education. Now, it's true that there's some inequities, and I've always fought against these inequities. You know, you're right. You know, people like in Yonkers, when we want to build a school, we get a lot less state reimbursement than people in Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse. And it really forces us to sometimes stall the need to address. Like right now in Yonkers, we're like 5,000 seats short. You know, we're a school district. You know, in Yonkers, we serve between public and private over 30,000 students. And we are like 5,000 seats short because our buildings, many of them are 100 years old. There's no ventilation over the years. And I can tell you as a principal how many times we have to take away music rooms and art rooms and sport facilities and libraries to convert them to classrooms, even establishing classrooms sometimes in the basements of schools. You know, what kind of learning atmosphere is that when you're a child and you have leaking roofs and you have a terrible ventilation system? Especially we've learned that with the pandemic, that schools and atmosphere for learning can be very detrimental. So, you know, we just broke ground earlier this month, you know, if you recall, the Sotomayor
School. Sotomayor School.
Yeah, Sotomayor School. And, you know, that was part of my plan. As board president, we approved 3 schools to be built. So, fortunately, a couple of years, but we had the shovels and we started the process of the first of 3. But a lot of that delay was
because... That's interesting because people don't realize that we haven't built a new school in Yonkers for over 20 years.
Exactly.
And they are over 100 years old. Does that impress, let's say, the state legislature? do they get it, or is there an adversity, or their need is so great that they have different needs, but they still have needs? How do you balance that?
You got to honestly, you got to have effective leadership. You got to have persistent leadership. You know, fortunately for me, I understand education. I understand the needs.
Yeah,
and you know, for me, I continue to speak up and I continue to sell the message of the need for equity and funding, not just as a Yonkers concern, because honestly, politics playing a role, we can understand that, look, you know, a lot of people don't want to see you hurt, but their attitude is, well, if I give you more of the pie, does that take away from me and my needs and my turf and my city and my community? So when I propose legislation to make changes, I do it in a way where, yes, it impacts Yonkers, but it's really a statewide fix. You know, when we talk about fixing the way we fund education, just off the top, you know, I just sponsored legislation that tells the state, when I checked and I saw that the state was using 2,000 data, you know, to determine funding, you know, in education, 2,000 data, we just did the 2020 census, and we're using data. Every high school kid in New York State wasn't even born in 2000. You know, so I said, how can you use data 22 years ago, you know, to determine, you know, equity and social justice and proper funding? It doesn't work. So right now I have a bill in Albany that people are saying, you know, you're right, Sage, you know, 22 years ago, and that's the data we're using. So that's something that is so simple that, you know, it's hard for people to debate, you know, just, hey, use the updated data. What's there to debate about that? Right. The other thing is, you know, the percentage of free and reduced lunch. I've always pushed the fact that the present state formula puts a lot of emphasis on the value of the county you live in. And we always say in Yonkers, yeah, we're part of Westchester. It's a rich county. We're next to New York City. We understand that. But then when you see that 75% of your student population is on free and reduced lunch, then, you know, I say to my colleagues across the state and state officials, hey, where's the correlation? That's not a best reflection of the economic status of the kids we serve or the parent, their parents. And people are saying, you know, you're right. It doesn't make sense. So it's getting traction. You know, I'm just happy that process is such where you can't give up. You got to continue to speak up. You got to do it in a diplomatic way. You got to let people know it benefits me here in Yonkers, but this also benefits communities all across the state, you know, in Ossining and Port Chester and communities throughout the state and the county. There's many communities that, in my opinion, would benefit with legislative changes like this and resolutions.
Mm-hmm. And what about communities that are wealthier? When we talk about Westchester County,
there's no need to name them
because it's not a question of shaming anybody because they are successful and that's terrific. But how do we balance that?
You're right. See,
because
for example,
such differences.
In many communities that are wealthy, for example, in this budget, many of these communities have volunteer firefighters, right? These firefighters are volunteer, you know, historically, they were not given the opportunity to bill for services for Medicare and Medicaid, right? So unlike regular fire departments that get municipal budgets and they get other funding sources, these volunteer service departments for many years have been crying out, and many of them are in wealthy communities, but, you know, that was an inequity of healthcare. When you're talking about emergency services, even in a wealthy community where they have a private, for example, EMS emergency service.
Right.
But if they don't have proper resources, then you have people that are either getting seriously ill or in many cases dying because of the lack of efficient care or response, for example. So that's an area where, even though you're dealing with a well-to-do community, but if there was an inequity in the proper care of emergency response, then that was really inequity for that community. So in this budget, we finally agreed that for these private fire departments, volunteer departments, EMS services, they can now get the proper opportunity to bill and get the funding so that they can have services that are efficient and similar to other communities. So, I mean, that's a good point you bring up, where sometimes you may argue, well, we're looking to promote equity. It's not always finance. Equity could be in the lack of health care, the lack of emergency response, mm-hmm. the lack of other services that are necessary. You know, we talked about taxation. Middle-class people in Yonkers and all across the state, you know, based on the prior federal administration, had that $10,000 limit on what you can deduct for taxes. Now, if you're paying a mortgage $1,000 and you can't even deduct it all, that's a major loss for a lot of people. So these tax credits, you know, are such where in this budget, because we fought hard and said, yeah, we want to address education and healthcare and social services, but at the same time, we want to protect middle class. We want to protect the homeowner, the small business owner. We don't want them to close shop. We don't want them to say, you know what, I can't even afford the taxes. I'm going to sell out and move out of New York. That's our concern. And this type of a budget, it's not finalized yet because, you know, I'm still online. We're still involved with finalizing the final pieces. But we know to a large extent, you know, negotiations have gone well. We've addressed the needs of every part of the state, in my opinion. We addressed the needs of education, healthcare. We addressed the needs of the farmers in upstate New York. We addressed the housing needs in New York City, the needs of workers and, you know, healthcare workers. We increased their salaries. So now they can look at their careers when they serve the senior population, the disabled, the home care workers. They can now feel good that they're earning a decent salary with benefits so that they can stay in this career. Because let's face it, we got nursing shortages, we have teacher shortages, we have healthcare shortages. We got to be proactive.
But that's been going on for like about 25 years. So what's changed? Is it that in these 25 years that we've been able to grow as a state? Is that where the economic impetus somehow has functioned? Is that necessarily a Republican or Democratic demeanor, or is it just circumstance that we're in a better place? And if we are in a better place, we can also function better.
Well, I think, New York State is a combination. It's it's not a one size fits, you know, it's a combination of, you know, you got the political lobbying, the Democrats are often social justice initiatives. You have Republicans that are more concerned, you know, with the taxation issues and the, you know, promoting industry and development. And you have a big branch, you know, where I fall in, which is a moderate approach that addresses social justice, addresses the needs of the franchise, while at the same time recognizing that for the state to function in the best way, for us to have that balance we need to protect homeowners, we need to protect businesses, we need to encourage investments and development. We can't be 100% pro-tenant or 100% pro-landlord. You got to find a system, and that's what I've been fighting for, to protect tenant rights.
What's fascinating about you is that somehow your life, you know, because you had a very humble beginning, you know, your big family, very humble beginning. You got it, an education. It was an investment by your parents. All your siblings are very successful people, and you've gone through, it seems, every level of education in your employment. So when you got elected into political office as an assembly member, I don't think even people were aware of what you would be able to introduce as a representative of the city of Yonkers, because I think you cover about what close to 90% of the city comes under your guidance under your watch.
Percent, but anybody knows, you know, I'm the only assemblyman there, you know, is totally in Yonkers. So
right.
You know, Yonkers. I don't differentiate.
But do people recognize that you need those bona fides in order to be in government, or do they just luck out with you? Because you've been delivering. That's the thing that's fascinating. Somehow or another, in our political world, we don't celebrate so much of the accomplishments of the people that are in office representing us. And there's a sense of ignorance, not because people are stupid, but they're just not made aware. And, you know, like, to me, well, you know, maybe I'm a political, you know, I love politics. I love to see the way people function and what they do and where they focus. But we don't get enough of that. You know, that should be like the food that we live, because how else are we going to know who to re-elect? Or to elect for the first time. This is mind-boggling to me. There's a disconnect there between the electorate and the elected.
You got to be people-oriented. I mean, you know, gas, for example, was really hurts the pockets of a lot of people. And many of us, I was happy to take the lead and encourage and, you know, relief. And one way was, you know, that we thought about was, you know, let's at least, and in this budget, for example, we propose, and it's in the budget, where they would cut tax, gas tax, by 16 cents a gallon between June 1st and December 31st. I mean, you know, this is one of the initiatives that, you know, would reduce gas costs at the pump, and in my opinion, really help a lot of people. Middle class tax cuts, you know, a lot of people will receive checks, you know, reimbursement or tax credit checks for child care, tax credit checks for, you know, restoring some of the STAR program funds. They'll start receiving checks sometime in the fall, my belief. And, you know, any way you can tell New Yorkers and people in Yonkers that, look, we got your back, you know, we heard the issues, we know the concerns, you know, with the MGM, you know, we've lobbied hard to make sure that the one of the three downstate licensing for full gambling and table goes to MGM. And we met and spoke with MGM leaders. You know, we get $19.6 million. That's like a benefit for Yonkers, where people across the state, you know, understand that, look, Yonkers has special needs. Nobody questions it. We're pushing to bring this up to $25, $30 million, you know, when MGM gets going and then the profits start coming in. So in addition to jobs and development, that's why when you look at, for example, an issue with the Buffalo Bills and the Buffalo Stadium, you know, some of us here in this region get upset and they say, well, why did we give the Buffalo Bills? But, you know, to my point earlier, about how sometimes you got to think of statewide economies and statewide circumstances. You know, some of us forget that for stadiums in our turf, you know, when you look at the past, there was state funding that helped Yankee Stadium, that helped Shea Stadium Field, for example. So what's the difference? You know, because those of us in the southern part of the state, we can't say, well, you know, Buffalo is far away from us. You know, that's necessary for the economy. We did it for the regional sport teams. you know, the next step is they may leave Buffalo if they don't get that support. So what are we supposed to do as state officials? Allow the Buffalo Bills to leave Buffalo? Already it's a declining economy, declining enrollment. You know, so you got to be smart. You got to be fair. You got to look
Isn't that also because you can only be fair if you're aware of the circumstance. Buffalo has been in the gutter for easy generation, 25, 30 years. They've not been able to rise up. They've been under struggle forever. You know, it's a great city. Well, I used to remember dating a girl up there, so I was very happy up there in Buffalo. However, but you know, that was a long time ago. But the point is that it was, which is a beautiful city, was always financially bereft, and it's amazing that it survived for so long. But yeah, they need assistance, like so many other communities need assistance.
And by the way, we spoke often this budget. You know, one of the stumbling blocks that really, in my opinion, delayed the process, even though it's not a long delay. You're talking about a week delay. You know, you've had times where, you know, the funding for New York State was on a standstill and the funding for legislators and government officials was on hold, where sometimes we went into, you know, late seasons with that budget. So, you know, we're on the right track. But one of the biggest issues that really, you know, caused a little bit of the debate, and rightfully so because it's a hot issue, it's an important issue, was bail reform. And, you know, the biggest debate, in my opinion, this past year has been the rise of crime and who's to blame for it. And people were extremely upset with the bail reform, you know, based on what they considered, you know, a direct result of, you know, the crime increase. And many of us looked at that, including myself, and said, you know what, the concept of bail reform is a good concept, it's fair, it promotes equity. If for a simple crime, if you and I commit and, you know, you cannot afford the bail, you go to jail, you don't go home, and I can afford the bail, so I get to go back to my family and home. That's inequitable. That's not fair. But then what we noticed, even though the system works for 95% of the time, the problem that I felt and many of us felt was the 5%. The 5% where, you know, to some extent, judges didn't have the discretion to hold repeat offenders or people that had, you know, a history of carrying guns, illegal guns.
Yeah, but you know, I never understood that. When did we extract the capacity of a judge to say, sorry, you've been doing this three or four times already. You got a record. We release you, you know, because we want to be magnanimous and give you an opportunity so you don't spend like 6 months or 5 years in jail. When did the judges drop that whole issue? When did we take it away from them? Is that the law that they're not permitted to do anything? They just have to release people because they're on the streets.
When we passed bail reform, you know, it was put together in 2017, 2018, and let's say by 2019, when the process took place, you know, the process, in my opinion, you know, should have had more effort from judges, from law enforcement, from the community, from the advocates. It should have been more fine-tuned. We know, I believe we rushed into it, and then back then...
It was a political rush to satisfy some people.
That's right.
Because of the discretions in the past. So do you think that we're on the right track now?
Well, I think, you know, we're better.
Are we going to be putting people away who are repeat offenders? Because they're out there.
You know what it is? The way the law was written, you know, we thought of it at the time, the people that packaged it and said, well, if you have a small-level crime like a misdemeanor, then, you know, you should you shouldn't impose bail and you should be more lenient. But then the realization set in that even though it wasn't a felony, a serious felony, but even if it was a misdemeanor, you know, but if you're letting the same person commit 10 misdemeanors right after each other,
right,
or they were just in and out of, you know, the courthouses and, you know, told you can go home, you know, then that's where the mistake was. That's where you have to say, wait a minute, even though it's a small level crime, but it's if you're robbing, you know, $800 worth from a local business and you continuously rob, you know, 5 times in a row or 10 times in a row and figure, well, each one on its face value is a small crime, you know, but you look at a pattern and you become a repeat criminal, then of course there should be bail. And of course you should tell the judge.
You know what's so
to
interesting, like,
criminal
history. I unfortunately I have to get medication because I got issues. But the point is that when I go to the drugstore, they've got like plexiglass that covers almost everything. This wasn't there a year ago, but there's so much theft going on, and nobody gets arrested, and they go through the process, and it's costing businesses a fortune of money. A fortune.
It is, and
the cops are overwhelmed by this sort of, you know, theft, and it causes delays for the consumer as well, astronomical. But people don't put it all together. The theft in the supermarkets and so on and so forth, it causes a rise in expenses to everyone, and including people who can't afford it. What do you think they're going to be doing with regard to this reform? And are we able to do all these things because we're getting financially better off? You know, we're going to be selling marijuana through outlets, but we're also permitting people who are not even authorized to sell marijuana. They're already, you know, selling marijuana through trucks that are not authorized. What the hell are we doing that we permit this sort of stuff to go on?
There's going to be a whole transition of, you know, as creative as, you know, as a society we think we're headed toward. I agree with you.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of reckoning with a lot of faults and a lot of issues. And, you know, similar with smoking bans and similar with prohibition on liquor years and, you know, and there comes a point when, you know, you got to put an extensive campaign, public relations, to warn people, even with sport betting, you know, even though it's going to generate a lot, you know, you got to be able to be concerned about, you know, addiction to sports, like addiction to drugs and addiction to alcohol and cigarettes. And, you know, there's one segment that tells you, you know, you live in a free society. You know, if somebody wants to do what they do, let them do it, but warn them and tell them the dangers of it. And there's some that demand restrictions. So, you know, our role in government and society is finding a balance where, hey, you want to smoke marijuana, fine, but, you know, don't drive and drink. Or if you smoke, you know, you're going to have health care, you're going to have lung disease, you're going to have cancer. You know, if you race and speed too much, you know, you risk dying because of car accidents. And, you know, we're living at a point where, you know, we've become very loose as a society, but at the same time, you know, we got to be proactive in making sure that if you choose to do what you do, at least recognize, you know, what the risks are. And in anything we do, becoming the norm. You know, with bail reform, the budget and the policy, you know, from the governor and what we compromised on includes more discretion to judges so that people with a history of guns, repeat offenders, you know, we can close what I call the revolving door. That's back to the 5% spoke about. These are people, the 5% that are committing the bulk of crimes, these are the people we got to close the revolving door on because they're committing the most crimes. And then with that, I think the bail reform process would be more fair. It would work better. And hopefully we can motivate law enforcement to be more proactive, because it seems to me that with the attacks against the law enforcement community, if you recall the days when people were calling for defunding police, that was terrible.
Yes.
I stand early on and said, you know what, work with police. I went out of my way and provided funding for the Yonkers police to do de-escalation training. Terrific programs that I met with the police commissioners and law enforcement people that said, you know what, that's what we need. We need the community to work with us, with government to work with us, to recognize that to make this work best, we got to work together. We got to understand that, you know, there isn't one best system that fits all needs. You got to be able to be creative. You got to be able to say, even if I initiated
Well, that's a question I have. For example, you've been able to afford the Assembly and the Senate, been able to afford all this funding for, you know, police, supporting the police. But, you know, in Yonkers, for example, one of the big issues is our police department, they're supposed to have like a pendant that can film whatever they're engaged in. We don't see any documentation for any of this stuff. Paid the money for this apparatus, so that there could be openness about what happened, what transpired. There is no record for all this stuff. Are we wasting our money? You got to either use it or you don't use it. But you know, why are we spending money and we don't use it?
Well, if you're spending money,
no documentation for anything. I want you to know.
There should be
I'm
documentation.
I'm not stupid. There isn't any.
Anytime there is, the expectation, people should be held accountable in any field when you're given funding.
I don't know how to hold them accountable. They don't respond. This is a real problem. I don't know if the same problem exists everywhere else, but certainly in Yonkers, it's a problem. We don't have documentation, and that's the problem.
I attended an event where, you know, we celebrated the Sherwood House. People don't realize here in Yonkers, you know, from the revolutionary time, you have the Sherwood House, you know, and having been, you know, very active with the Historical Society over the years and their activities and been a Parks Board member here in Yonkers, it really makes me proud. And I mentioned to the crowd yesterday, they honored the mayor. But I said, you know, even on the Assembly level, you know, I went out of my way to sponsor resolutions, of course, celebrating BMX and his life and legacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people don't realize that the Otis Elevator, we did a special resolution, and I really bragged about how it's a Yonkers business. And when you go up to Albany, I go all over the world and you see Otis Elevator, right away it's pride, you know. Or the sugar, refined sugar, you know, made in Yonkers, New York, and you go on cruises and trips.
But why don't we celebrate that? Why don't we celebrate that? Why have we forgotten the history?
It's so rich in Yonkers. The entire state assembly and Senate now, and even recently, when I looked into it, do you know that FM radio, you know,
started here in Yonkers.
It was initiated in Yonkers, New York.
People
don't know that. People say, whoa, you know, FM radio out of Yonkers, New York.
We're not doing it in the schools. The schools the kids aren't being taught that. Maybe our teachers don't know what's going on. We've got to get it back, because that's what defines Yonkers. And we've lost it. It's over 50 years old. This whole city has literally been reduced to practically where it is right now, even though it's now climbing out of it with guidance like through you. But the point is that history has moved. You know, Otis is not here anymore. I think they're up in Connecticut. And the companies have moved south. So that sucking sound of that diminished the capacity of a city like Yonkers is gone. But we should celebrate it. We might be able to generate a new type of business, new energy in the city. Amazing.
With Yonkers on the Hollywood, on the Hudson.
That should help.
That's potentially a whole new generation where now, from what I understand, Lionsgate, looking at other properties, is in a position of having the biggest, their biggest movie production stage presence here in Yonkers, New York.
In the metropolitan area.
Yeah, so it's interesting that, the bottom line is, we spoke about a lot of good things. We speak about the practicality of how negotiations and how budgets and how, a combination of politics and needs and concerns all interplay when we come up with final resolutions. And, is everybody going to be happy with this budget? I'm sure not. But I can tell you that even upstate people and Republicans were happy with the aid to farmers, with the small tax business incentives, middle class, with the, as I said earlier, about the volunteer firefighters. And so I think all in all, there's a good slice for everyone. And it's very difficult, to see anyone that would come out of this and say, well, I was totally ignored. I think at the end of the day,
right. That would be incorrect. Yeah. That wouldn't be right.
But it's a good start.
Well, they
got
to walk in your shoes, as they say, in order to be able to recognize that. A lot of people don't have that ability.
So we gotta combine between staying busy with the assembly and this is for me in a re-election year. I have a re-election in November. But I'm looking forward to it, and I base it on my track record. I base it on my constituent services. My office, I think, has been one of the most active legislative offices, especially during the pandemic. We never closed our door, whether it's unemployment claims or information on vaccination. We pushed hard to get the state to get a vaccination site right here in Yonkers. And, we'll continue to lobby. My job is I'm there to protect the interests of Yonkers. A small part of it is also the rest of the state. But, my concern is Yonkers. And whether it's finalizing the MGM, it's making sure the schools get the funding they need. We increase the AIM, municipality funding, for municipalities like Yonkers and across, so that we can make sure the roads are paved, that the streets are clean, that, that we provide quality of services for people right here in Yonkers, New York. So we're on the right track.
Well, evidently you are. Thank you very, very much. My hat comes off to you. I think you're doing an exceptionally brilliant job. I'm very proud of you. And I'm very proud that you represent Yonkers, because that's where I function. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Hezi. Have a good day. And thank you for all you do to disseminate information and help making us all more aware. Because not only listening audience learns more, but I learn more when I have an opportunity to speak and communicate and really express what's going on. Because at the end of the day, the more we communicate, the more the public and constituents understand what's going on, the better. Mm. And for me, it helps me get feedback, helps me make sure that I know the beat to the community I serve, and to make sure that when we do legislate and reach out and set policy and new resolutions and so forth, that we do what's best in the interest of Yonkers. So thank you, Hezi, for your work.
Well, thank you. All the best. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Goodbye. There we have it, folks. None other than New York State Assembly member Nader Sage. He represents the 90th Assembly District, which is I think he's the only member of the assembly whose only responsibility happens to be one community, and that community is Yonkers. I don't think anyone else has that, because they have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. It's just amazing. And I guess that also probably gives a tremendous impetus and capacity of the legislator, in this case, Mayor Sayers, to be able to focus his entire, effort and demeanor and understanding of the community, because it's one. Even though, let's face it, each different neighborhood in Yonkers is a little bit different than the other. And they say that Yonkers is a little bit of country and a little bit of rock and roll, and that's exactly who we are. We have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. We have a little bit of salsa. We have a little bit of pepper. We have a little bit of this and that. And our politics is the same way. It is absolutely astounding and exhilarating at the same time. So if one takes the challenge of celebrating the city of Yonkers, which I certainly do, and that doesn't mean that everything is hunky-dory, don't get me wrong. But the point is that if you look at it from that perspective of the different facets and different milieu and environment that people live in, the circumstance, financial, social, educational, and when you put it all together, you see a panoply, a kaleidoscope of people, attitudes, and demeanor that actually, whether people realize it or not, is a celebration of this city and its survivability. And has a long history, too often forgotten. Maybe that's the thing that me a sense of understanding, because to me it was a learning experience. I'm not a native. Native of Yonkers. I didn't even know where Yonkers was till 22 years ago. I never even heard of Yonkers. But, you know, so once I got involved in the media business, and I said, oh, wow, so this is Yonkers. And it was a tremendous learning experience. And 22 years later, I'm still learning. And I think that's really the key, to still be curious, still be understanding, still be tolerant, still be, critical in a positive way, rather than in a negative way, to find different facets of demeanor, attitude, and understand what drives it. And when you sense all of that, this hodgepodge and this stew that it defines Yonkers with all its complexity, then you'll have a sense of who this city really is. And there's a lot to celebrate. Unfortunately, it's been diminished by a lot of naysayers who cannot recognize the panache, the beauty, the relevance, the struggles, the challenges, and the success of the city, despite its history and because of its history. And this is where the disconnect lies. But some people are just critical, but they don't balance their criticism with a celebration of what is positive. And I think that that's where, at least I find, well, you know, who am I to make a decision on what I do specifically? Of course, I have a demeanor and an attitude. I think probably, I believe, most predominantly positive. But you never know. There are always failures in every individual. Maybe I shouldn't talk about others, but in myself, there are certainly things that might be diminished by my attitude, or maybe I freak some people out because I'm a little bit too in your face for some people. And a lot of people have thin skins, you know, but so it is. But, you know, there is a reality we live in. You can't play a game of hodgepodge on everything. So that's a story. Anyway, I spent too much time talking about Yonkers, but as always, it's always a pleasure to talk to Nita Sayers, the assembly member representing the 90th district. So let's look at what else is going on the world stage, which is really very, very important. Evidently, there was a rocket attack at Kramatorsk train station, which was used for evacuations. At least 50 people were killed and dozens were wounded in a rocket strike in eastern Ukraine as civilians tried to evacuate to safer parts of the country. Eastern Ukrainian train station used by civilians to flee the war. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky points to war crimes in Borodyanka. Microsoft claims to have disrupted Russian hacking. And Russian-appointed Mariupol mayor claims 5,000 people killed in the city. Johnson and Scholz address the conflict in London. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Prime Minister Boris Johnson are holding a joint press conference in London after holding talks on the war in Ukraine. Johnson called the train station attack at Kramatorsk unconscionable, quote unquote. He also said that Britain would deliver further military assistance to Ukraine, including air defense and anti-tank missiles. Johnson, who spoke first, said that Russian President Vladimir Putin had failed to divide Europe, but rather forced the continent to rearm together with regards to untangling European dependence on Russian fossil fuels. Scholz said that Germany is working to become, quote, independent from Russian oil. Scholz added that Germany will be able to substitute Russian oil imports already this year, but this isn't easy and that there is, quote, infrastructure that needs to be built first. You can watch the press conference if you wanted to, and there are some updates that you need to know about. Warsaw summons the French ambassador over Macron's comments. Poland said it called the French ambassador in Warsaw after French President Emmanuel Macron called Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki by, quote, a right-wing anti-Semite who bans LGBT people, end quote. Foreign Ministry spokesman Lukasz Jasina spoke on Twitter, quote, as a result of assertions by the French president in an interview with Le Parisien, Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau decided to summon the French ambassador. The comments were made ahead of the first round of Sunday's French presidential election in an interview with Le Parisien newspaper, the first diplomatic spat among European Union nations since Russia invaded Ukraine, follows a week of the two leaders trading barbs over Macron's repeated phone calls to Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Earlier in the week, Morawiecki had asked Macron while speaking to reporters, quote, how many times have you negotiated with Putin and what have you achieved? He went on to say, nobody negotiated with dictators like Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, or Pol Pot, though in truth, for a time they did. Well, the death toll from a rocket strike on a train station in eastern Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk has risen. Ukrainian officials said at least 50 people have now died as a result of the missile strike, said regional governor Pavlo Kirilenko. Now, some 12 people were killed at the scene of the strike, while a further 38 later died from their injuries in hospital, Kirilenko had said. Five children were among those killed, he said. The station of Kramatorsk had been used by civilians fleeing fighting in East Ukraine. Kramatorsk mayor said the evacuation by road is beginning. Kramatorsk local authorities were starting to evacuate residents by buses and cars, according to the mayor of the city, Oleksandr Honcharenko. Today, we are starting an emergency evacuation of people with all public transport, all private transport. We are looking for drivers. Approximately 30 to 40 drivers are needed as of today, Honcharenko said during an online briefing. Earlier on Friday, Ukraine and Russian missiles struck the train station Kramatorsk. The civilians came to the train station to be evacuated to safer parts of the country. of the European Union governments have frozen 29.5 billion euros, that's $32 billion, in assets linked to Russian individuals with ties to the Kremlin, the European Commission said today. Frozen assets include bank accounts, boats, helicopters, real estate, and artwork valued at almost 6.7 billion euros. It's about $7 billion. Additionally, the European Union had blocked approximately 196 billion euros worth of transactions. It said that's about 225 billion U.S. dollars. However, the Commission had no estimate for the total value of oligarchs' assets in the European Union. Slovakia is providing Ukraine with S-300 air defense systems. Slovakian Prime Minister Eduard Heger announced that his country had provided Ukraine with an air defense system S-300. Ukrainian nation is bravely defending its sovereign country and us too. It is our duty to help, not to stay put and be ignorant to the loss of human lives under Russia's aggression, Heger wrote on Twitter. At the end of March, the United States Patriot air defense system was deployed in Slovakia as a replacement for Soviet-designed S-300s. NATO is ready to provide Ukraine with weapons for years to come. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the alliance was ready to supply Ukraine with weapons for the fight against Russia for years to come. Speaking to BBC Radio, Stoltenberg said, quote, allies are ready to provide even more and also more modern and heavier weapons, end quote. NATO foreign ministers on Thursday agreed to accelerate arms deliveries. Quote, we're not going to let anything stand in the way of getting Ukraine what they need and what we believe to be effective, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said after the meeting in Brussels. He spoke of new systems, quote-unquote, but declined to go into details about what specific systems he was referring to. Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, said that Kyiv urgently needed weapons, including air defense systems, artillery, armored vehicles, and jets. Zelensky is calling for European embargo on Russian oil. Addressing the Parliament of Finland, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky informed lawmakers about the rocket strike in Kramatorsk and asked them to honor the memory of the victims with a minute of silence. Russian forces hit the train station in Kramatorsk, firing on an ordinary train station and ordinary people. There were no soldiers there, he said. The Russian army can commit the Bucha-like atrocities in any other city, Zelensky said. You've all seen what the Russian military has done in Bucha, but they do such Buchas every day from Kramatorsk to Mariupol, from Kharkiv to Kherson, the Ukrainian leader had said. Zelensky called on Europe to stop paying for oil from Russia by accumulating money in special accounts Russia will not have access to. How much longer can Europe ignore the need to impose an embargo on oil supplies from Russia? I ask you to raise this issue loudly to everyone in the European Union so that the necessary solution can finally be found, the president had said. Zelensky thanked Finland for providing Ukraine with defensive support and asked for further arms, supplies, and sanctions. Quote, we need the weapons that your European Union partners have. We need effective, powerful sanctions against Russia, and such a sanctions cocktails will be necessary and remembered as Molotov cocktails, he said. Finland's government website and those of several ministries were hit by a cyber attack at the same time that Zelensky gave a video address to the parliament of the country, its government reported. Well, the European Union, United Nations, and other diplomats are returning to Kyiv. The head of the European Union delegation to Ukraine, Mati Maasikos, returned to Kyiv to reestablish Europe's diplomatic presence there. The European Union representation was completely evacuated from the country a day after the start of the war. Maasikos was expected to resume his post in the Ukrainian capital with a small team. He traveled on a train with European Union Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the bloc's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, to Ukraine. Their trip is intended to show solidarity with Ukraine and meet with its president, Volodymyr Zelensky. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres' spokesperson, Stefan Dujarric, said that the United Nations would also reestablish its presence in Kyiv after the temporary redeployment of key personnel. Many other diplomats were still operating from the western city of Lviv. Well, Russia and Belarus are slammed with another round of European Union sanctions. The European Union on Friday officially passed heavy economic sanctions on Russia and Belarus, the fifth of such a package since the invasion of Ukraine. Russian coal and other solid fossil fuels will be banned in the European Union from August 2022, according to a statement. Russian businesses linked to the Ukraine war, oligarchs, high-ranking Kremlin officials, as well as four Russian banks were hit with immediate asset freezes and a ban on bank and crypto transactions. The sanctions follow alleged atrocities committed by Russian troops in Bucha and other parts of Ukraine. Josep Borrell, European Union's foreign policy chief, said that the goal of the sanctions is to, quote, stop the reckless, inhumane, and aggressive behavior of the Russian troops, end quote. Other materials from a wide range of industries were cut off too, including Russian wood, cement, fertilizers, seafood, and liquor. Meanwhile, ports, roads, and highways within the European Union will now be off limits to Russian and Belarusian vehicles, excluding those transporting food and medicine or used in a humanitarian context. Russia and Belarus will also no longer have access to the Union's jet fuels and advanced technology equipment, including quantum computers. Russia is an evil that has no limits, Zelensky had said. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called Russia an, quote, evil that has no limits, end quote, following a rocket attack on a train station in eastern Ukraine. The governor of the Donetsk region said 39 people were killed and 89 wounded. In a Facebook post, Zelensky said that Russian forces hit the Kramatorsk railway station where thousands of Ukrainian civilians were waiting to be evacuated with a Toshka-U missile. About 4,000 people, most of them elderly women and children, were at a railway station when it was hit, Mayor Oleksandr Honcharenko had said. Lacking the strength and courage to stand up to us on the battlefield, the Russians are cynically destroying the civilian population. This is an evil that has no limits, and if it is not punished, it will never stop, Zelensky had said. Russia denied responsibility for the attack. Typical. Ukrainian negotiator says there will be no temporary ceasefire with Russia. Ukrainian negotiator Mykhailo Podolyak said that Ukraine and Russia are constantly, quote-unquote, holding peace talks online. But the mood of the talks has changed after the atrocities in Bucha and other towns near Kyiv came to light. Quote, this is not a question of actual negotiations, but the emotional background on which these negotiations are conducted. Ukrainian society is now much more negative about any negotiating concept that concerns Russia, Podolyak said in an interview with the online publication RBC Ukraine. He also ruled out a temporary ceasefire with Russia. Quote, a temporary truce with the Russian Federation is always a way to further escalation in war, he said. It cannot be. A temporary truce is an incentive for Russia to make further and take further aggressive action. According to Podolyak, Ukraine will not accept Minsk III or Budapest II, the reiterations of the Minsk Agreement of 2005 or the Budapest Memorandum of 1994 editions. In the historical perspective, even in the short term, all these Minsks lead to great tragedies. All these agreements will not work without real preventive mechanism to prevent war, Podolyak had said. Well, the rocket attack hits the train station in eastern Ukraine. Two Russian rockets struck the train station Kramatorsk in eastern Ukraine, according to the Ukrainian state railway company. More than 30 people were killed and over 100 were wounded. The civilians came to the train station to be evacuated to safer parts of the country. Thousands of people were at the station during the missile strike as residents of Donetsk region are being evacuated to safer regions of Ukraine. The governor of Donetsk, Bolast Pavlo Kirilenko, wrote in his telegram. He said he thought Russian forces aimed to keep civilians from fleeing. Well, Russia did not immediately comment on the reports of the attack on the casualty toll. Moscow had denied targeting civilians since invading Ukraine on February 24. Well, the war has cut Ukraine's harvest by 20%. Ukraine's harvest, grain harvest, will likely fall by about one-fifth of last year's total, Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal said on Friday. The Russian invasion and ensuing war have hit farmers hard, shrinking cultivated land area and reducing critical fuel supplies, the leader had said. Officials said that with limits placed on grain exports, they do not expect the smaller harvest to affect the domestic food supply. But North African, Asian, and Middle Eastern countries that depend on Ukrainian grain are already, Nations Food Agency warned this week. Food prices are soaring, and prolonged fighting could, quote, seriously escalate food insecurity globally, end quote, said Ku Dongyu, the head of the Food and Agriculture Organization. Quote, world food commodity prices made a significant leap in March to reach their highest levels ever as war in the Black Sea region spread shocks through markets for staple grains and vegetable oils, the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization said in a statement. Alongside Russia, Ukraine was one of the world's biggest corn and wheat exporters before the war. Its fertile regions in Kherson, Zaporizhia, and Odessa have been occupied by Russian troops at one time or the other since February. Many farmers have also been displaced or joined the military. Russia claims it struck a foreign fighter's base near Odessa. Well, Russia's defense ministry said it destroyed a base used by foreign fighters near Odessa. High-precision missiles from the Bastion coastal missile system near the village of Krasnozelka, northeast of Odessa, destroyed the foreign mercenaries' collection and a training center. The Russian news agency TASS quoted Defense Ministry spokesman Igor Konashenkov as saying, there was no immediate confirmation from Ukrainian authorities, but Odessa city officials earlier wrote on Telegram that the southern city was hit by missile strikes and, quote, infrastructure facilities in the Odessa region were affected, end quote. After Russia invaded Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky invited foreign volunteers to fight alongside Ukrainians. The Ukrainian Defense Ministry said that around 20,000 foreign fighters from 52 countries had volunteered. Ukraine aims for 10 humanitarian corridors to fleeing civilians. Ukrainian Deputy Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk said that officials have negotiated 10 routes to evacuate citizens from besieged cities in Ukraine following days of talks. Residents from the heavily devastated southeastern Mariupol may now leave the city and head west to Zaporizhia, Verushchuk said in a statement. Now, those trapped in the Russian-occupied towns of Berdyansk, Tokmak, and Energoda have also been directed to head west. In the eastern Donetsk region, residents close to the administrative city of Bakhmut may also head there. Residents will have to travel in their cars, however, the statement said. The drive is about 3 to 5 hours. Well, the European Union's von der Leyen and Borrell are traveling to Kyiv in a show of support. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the bloc's diplomatic chief, Josep Borrell, were traveling to Ukraine. They were due to meet President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv for talks, and both European leaders shared pictures of their trip on social media. Well, the visit comes ahead of a solidarity event in Warsaw on Saturday. It is the second such trip from European Union officials. European Parliament President Roberto Metsola went to Ukraine last week. Well, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is meeting Prime Minister Boris Johnson in London. The meeting would focus on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Both countries are part of NATO and the G7 and support sanctions against Russia. And Johnson has been very vocally urging Europe to move away from its reliance on Russian energy. And Germany has supported the European Union coal import ban, but said ending gas and oil imports would take longer. So that's where we've been, and that's where we've been seeing what's been going on. Now, this is very, very important. Germany has intercepted Russian troop calls on atrocities in Ukraine. That's from a report. German intelligence has reportedly intercepted messages by Russian troops discussing murders in the Ukrainian city, a Ukrainian town. And citing the report and other atrocities, two German ex-ministers are seeking a war crimes probe. The German Foreign Intelligence Agency, BND, intercepted radio messages from Russian military sources discussing the murders of civilians in Ukrainian town of Bucha. German news magazine Der Spiegel, The Mirror, reported on Thursday. Images of bodies lying on the road in Bucha have shocked the world. The small town, 37 kilometers or 23 miles northwest of Kyiv, was occupied by Russian troops for more than a month since they invaded Ukraine on February 24. And according to local officials, more than 300 people were killed by Russian forces in Bucha, including 50 who were executed. So Russia denied committing atrocities in Bucha, claiming without evidence that they were staged by Ukraine, and several groups have rebutted the Russian claims. It's more this false narrative that they come up with. This is very interesting when it comes to German. There's a term in German which is pronounced Putin-Verstehe. Putin, of course, for President Putin. Verstehe means to understand or to sympathize. So the German word used to describe Putin sympathizers now has its own English Wikipedia page. But what does Putin-Verstehe mean, and who does it refer to? If an entry in Wikipedia is considered some marker of acknowledgement of the present day, then the world should be on the lookout for the new English language page dedicated to the German word Putin-Verstehe, which translates literally to one who understands Putin. It's like saying you're a woman, Verstehe, you know, you understand women. Well, the term combines the name of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, with the German noun Verstehe, which means understander. With its own English language Wikipedia page, the word joins other German terms that have come into use in the English language over recent years. One prominent example is Lügenpresse, a slur popular in the Nazi era that translates roughly to lying press. Lügen is lying. Presse is press, meaning media, used to discredit media reports that do not align with the user's ideology. In recent years, the term made a comeback under the far-right Alternative für Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany party, and by Donald Trump supporters in the United States. When Verstehe is added to the word, to the end of a word in German, it's typically done to indicate a mix of irony and flattery, as a recent Economist article pointed out. For example, a Frauenversteher, a woman understander, typically describes a man who boasts excessively about his relations with women. Likewise, a Putin-Verstehe is often used to describe someone who expresses empathy for Russian President Putin. The term, which was already in use following Russia's annexation of Crimea, typically has a negative connotation, and particularly since the invasion of Ukraine on February 24. When Russia launched its attack on Ukraine, people could be described as Putin-Verstehe, including prominent German politicians and talk show pundits. Wood, for example, point out that NATO's eastward expansion should be understood as a real threat to Russia, or would compare the invasion of Ukraine to the United States' 2003 invasion of Iraq, which was another illegal war. Not to say that such Putin-Verstehe, which is also the plural, supports the current violence, but rather, as Wikipedia puts it, their attitude towards President Putin and the way he is leading Russia might involve some sort of, yes, but you have to understand Putin's position. Also widespread among Putin-Verstehe is a strategy widely known as whataboutism, or deflecting criticism of Russia by pointing to different abuses committed in the West. Putin-Verstehe across the political spectrum. Well, the sentiment can be found across the political spectrum in Germany, and particularly among populist parties, though some politicians who were labeled as Putin-Verstehe following the annexation of Crimea may have since backtracked or at least stopped stating their support publicly. many of Europe's far-right political parties, members of Germany's far-right party, Alternative für Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany, have maintained close ties with Russia in recent years. Following the invasion of Ukraine, however, the party struggled to adopt a single position. Former co-leader of Germany's left party, Sarah Wagenknecht, was also renowned for trying to justify Putin's actions. Quote, maybe we should just take Russia seriously and respect that it has security interests, end quote. She said, for instance, on a talk show in February, days before the invasion of Ukraine. Well, their English language writers use it as well. Before the term obtained its Wikipedia entry, and before Russia's current war on Ukraine, the word Putin-Versteher was already used in various English language articles. In a January 2021 article published on Riddle, R-I-D-D-L-E, a political analysis website that focuses on Russia, political scientist and historian Dmitry Stratievsky looked into whether Armin Laschet, who served as the leader of the Christian Democratic Union, Chancellor Merkel's right, center-right party, should be seen as a Merkelian Putin-Versteher for his support of Germany's reliance on Russian gas. Paul Gregory, a professor of economics at Houston University, who has a blog on Forbes, used the term in the title of an article in April of 2014, quote, emphasizing with the devil how Germany's Putin-Versteher's shield Russia, end quote. It details how a number of top-level German politicians have sided with Russia, despite its government's poor human rights record and the annexation of Crimea. Well, Gregory cites a former German Chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, who led the country from 1998 to 2005 as one of the most egregious Putin-Verstehers. Schröder, who masterminded the Nord Stream gas pipeline project together with Putin while he was still chancellor, later became head of the supervisory board of the Russian state energy company Rosneft. Rosneft. Neft is oil, but I don't know what Ros part is. Maybe there's like Russian oil, I think is probably where it comes from. He is considered to be a personal friend of the Russian president. We're talking about Schröder. Even as Russia invaded Ukraine, Schröder refrained from making comments that could incriminate the Russian regime, so much so that all employees in his office resigned. In mid-March, Schröder even flew to Moscow and spoke with the Russian president in person. But as new atrocities in the war in Ukraine are reported daily, such as reports of targeted killings of citizens and mass graves in Bucha, calls to sanction Schröder himself have been growing in Germany, and the arguments typically used by Putin-Versteher have definitely lost their credibility. Unbelievable. These are the sort of things that are taking place. This is very interesting as well. Wounded Russian soldiers are filling the Belarusian hospitals. Well, since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, dead and wounded Russian soldiers have been arriving in Belarus. Most officials and doctors refuse to talk openly about the specific numbers, and details remain sketchy. So since Russian forces invaded Ukraine on February 24, the Russian Defense Ministry has reported its military losses just once. As of March 2nd, it said 498 soldiers had been killed and 1,590 had been wounded. The Ukrainian officials, on the other hand, have said that there are at least 14,200 dead on the Russian side. Probably neither side is telling the truth, but you never know. According to Belarusian media reports and telegram channels, many wounded Russian soldiers are being brought to Belarus to receive medical care before being transported to Russia. Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko confirmed as much, saying that after 5 days of war, between 160 and 170 Russian soldiers had received treatment in the cities of Gomel, Mazil, and another Belarusian town. Four sources advised Deutsche Welle that there were Russian soldiers in these southern Belarusian cities. Furthermore, they said a field hospital was set up in Norovilia, but far from the border with Ukraine. One source advised Deutsche Welle that many wounded soldiers arrived in Mazil, without arms, legs, ears, and eyes. They said that some arrived too late and already had gangrene. If they are brought in time, their limbs can still be rescued. The source said that some of the wounded had not eaten for 5 days, arrived disoriented, and wanted to call their parents. These are patients who were born in 2003 from poor regions of Russia. Basically, they are still children. A separate source directly involved in healthcare, but well-informed about the situation, said that surgery were being performed nonstop at a hospital in the region of Gomel, up to 50 per night, including routine operations on civilians. The person said that often surgeons had to amputate the limbs of the Russian soldiers. The hospital is full, said the source, asking that the location of the hospital not be made public. Several people told Deutsche Welle that the dead soldiers were also being transported to Belarus. However, nobody could give a precise figure. Many doctors contacted by Deutsche Welle refused to talk about treating Russian soldiers. Two sources said the doctors had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. The Belarusian Medical Solidarity Foundation confirmed that all hospitals were under strict control. There are KGB or FSB employees on the staff. All buildings are under surveillance. Many doctors who could, in theory, have said something have been removed from the hospitals and replaced by Russians, a spokesperson said, adding that many doctors and hospital employees were afraid to talk about what they had seen or done. The spokesperson said that since hospitals in Belarus were overwhelmed, quote, when possible, the wounded are being brought to Russia by train, and confirmed that there were also many dead soldiers. The Belarusian Health Ministry has not addressed the issue of medical care being provided to members of the Russian military. Tiahai Bodan from the Friedrich Meinecke Institute of History at Freie Universität Berlin told Deutsche Welle that from the perspective of international humanitarian law, to provide assistance to injured Russian soldiers did not equate to being complicit in the war. One has to help all the wounded, regardless of which army they belong to, he said, in a battle zone as well as in its vicinity, end quote. However, he explained that there were legal nuances to the argument, and because Russia was not officially describing the conflict as a war, the norms of international convention did not necessarily apply. The Kremlin's choice to refer to the war as a special operation, quote unquote, also complicates the status of wounded Russian soldiers in Belarus. Budan said he did not think Belarusian authorities explicitly wanted to conceal that their hospitals provided treatment to Russian soldiers and put their reticence down to the discipline and bureaucratic culture that had developed in the country. Budan said that Lukashenko did not want to participate in the invasion of Ukraine and was doing everything in his power not to get drawn into it. For Belarus, it is important to show that it is not doing anything serious against Ukraine, but is forced to cooperate with Russia, Bodan had said. The fact that Belarusian hospitals are accepting wounded soldiers is, one could say, a mild form of participation on Russia's side. But from a humanitarian point of view, it is not a participation in the war. He added that Russia moving its military equipment toward Ukraine via Belarusian territory could also make Minsk complicit, but that a court would need to hear that case for it to hold water. What was not yet clear is whether the Belarusian government was given the option to decide if it should let the equipment through. There are serious doubts here, said Bodan, adding that Lukashenko was confronted with the fact that the Russian army, which had come to Belarus for maneuvers, was participating in an attack on Ukraine. He concluded that this would confirm that though Ukraine and Russia were preparing themselves for war and taking appropriate measures along what they thought would be the front line, Belarus had not. And this was why wounded soldiers were now being treated in civilian hospitals in Belarus. Now, this article was originally published in Russian. Okay, so let's just look at some other things here as we move along. Bear with me a second. Okay. All right, we only have a little bit more time, so let me just quickly look. Bear with me a second as I move along here. I can't believe it's already Friday. There's so much to do. Anyway, let me just quickly look and see what I'm doing because I don't know what I'm doing now. Get a little stressed out of the last 15 minutes, as they say. One second here. This is important. Evidently, Shanghai and its 26 million people are under lockdown to curb the spread of COVID-19. So confronted by a sharp increase in COVID-19 infections, authorities across China are stepping up coronavirus control measures, including restrictions on movement, mass testing, and new quarantine centers. Shanghai on Friday announced a record 21,000 new cases and a third consecutive day of COVID-19 testing as a lockdown of 26 million people showed no sign of easing, and other Chinese cities tightened curbs even in places with no recent infections. I think there's a resurgence here as well. So these are going to be major, major problems. This is what's happening in France. The race for the Élysée Palace for 2022 shows that Macron's lead narrows ahead of the first round of the French elections. All of a sudden, it's neck and neck in the race for the French presidential election. Emmanuel Macron was sitting pretty and on course for a second term. So how has April turned into the cruelest month for the sitting French president? Well, Macron's second term is facing a real threat from far-right candidate Marine Le Pen, as polls show a closing of the gap between the incumbent and his main rival. And the question is, could he really lose? And it's conceivable. He is losing ground very quickly. A lot of people are disappointed he spent more time with President Putin than telling the people in France what needed to be done. One second here. All right, 1 second. Okay, it turns out that an Israeli security force has killed a Palestinian shooter in a deadly Tel Aviv terror attack. At least two people were killed on Thursday and several wounded in a shooting spree in the Israeli coastal city of Tel Aviv, the latest in a series of violence in Israel and the occupied West Bank since late March. The attacker, a Palestinian, was shot to death on Friday by Israeli security forces. The attack sparked mayhem in Dizengoff Street. I remember it when it was always thought of as Dizengoff Straße, which is a Straße street in German. Anyway, so it's Dizengoff Street, a popular night spot full of bars and restaurants. Well, it's really the hub, center of the life of Tel Aviv. Israeli security forces already are on high alert when the shooting took place, prompting a major manhunt. The man was killed by Israeli security forces after the hours-long search for him through the city. The bar attack was the latest in a string of deadly street assaults that have left 13 people dead and shaken the country. Now, Defense Minister Benny Gantz said that Israel would broaden its operations against the, quote, wave of terror, end quote, and that the attackers and those who send them will pay, quote, a heavy price, end quote. The officers found the shooter hiding near a mosque in Jaffa, just south of Tel Aviv. Israel's Shin Bet, the security agency, said. Now, during an exchange of fire, the attacker was killed, the agency also said. Shin Bet identified the shooter as a 28-year-old Palestinian from Jenin, a city in the occupied West Bank, who was in Israel illegally. Now, no group immediately claimed responsibility for the attack, but the Palestinian Islamist movement Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip, and the Islamic Jihad both praised it. Witnesses advised that they had heard gunfire and saw scenes of chaos. It's an atmosphere of war. Soldiers and police are everywhere. They search the restaurants and people are crying, said Benjamin Bloom, who works in a restaurant near the scene. Two people were killed and four others seriously wounded. The Magen David Adom, that's the ambulance service, emergency service, had said. Now, 16 people have evacuated to hospitals, two dead, four seriously wounded, said the spokesperson, Zaki Hella. Tel Aviv's Ichilov Hospital confirmed that two people were killed and, quote, several seriously injured, end quote. Most of them were seriously wounded with various kind of injuries, mainly in the thoracic region, in the abdomen, and some in the face, the hospital director, Ronnie Gamzu, had told the Agence France-Presse. Well, police spokesman Baruch Honig, Baruch is blessing, Honig is honey, so blessed honey, which is really is very interesting because Honig is German for honey and Baruch is blessing in Hebrew. It's amazing how this person got that name. Said that more than 1,000 policemen were deployed in Tel Aviv. It is so wonderful to speak so many different languages. It just comes to, you know, like, whoa, what was it, a shock of a name. So anyway, they cordoned off the scene of the attack, asking people to stay indoors while they tracked down suspects, a police statement had said. Unverified social media images showed panicked people fleeing the scene with glass carpeting the ground. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken condemned the terrorist attack, quote-unquote, and said that Washington would, quote, continue to be in regular contact with our Israeli partners with whom we stand resolutely in the face of senseless terrorism and violence, end quote. Now, outside a cafe, a man comforted a woman sitting on a bar stool as heavily armed ployed nearby. Witnesses said that they'd heard gunshots. Brenda Ehrlich, 31, an insurance agent from the Tel Aviv suburb of Holon, said she learned of the attack as she rode a bus into the city to celebrate a friend's birthday. I feel like I'm on high alert, she said, as she and her friend took cover. I feel like I need to look in all directions to not be caught by surprise. We were thinking of heading home, but it feels a little dangerous, so we might stay inside in Tel Aviv before we go home, Ehrlich had added. Ehrlich is another interesting word. That's another German word, which means honestly. So Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was an army headquarters in the coastal city receiving updates on the fourth attack in just over 2 weeks in Israel. He sent his condolences to the bereaved families in a statement and said that, quote, security forces are in pursuit of the terrorist who carried out the murderous rampage tonight in Tel Aviv, end quote. And then continuing the quote, he says, wherever the terrorist is, we'll get to him. And everyone who helped him indirectly or directly will pay a price, end quote, Bennett had said. On March 29, a Palestinian gunman opened fire with an M16 assault rifle in Bnei Brak, a mostly Jewish Orthodox city near Tel Aviv. He killed two Ukrainian men and two Israeli civilians. An Arab-Israeli officer died of wounds sustained in an ensuing gunfight that also killed the assailant. 2 days earlier, terrorists opened fire and killed two police officers in the northern city of Hedera before officers shot dead the assailant, police said. On March 22nd, a convicted Islamic State group sympathizer killed four Israelis in a stabbing and car ramming spree in the southern city of Beersheba. And in the wake of the previous attacks, Israeli security forces arrested dozens of people suspected of Islamic State links. And last Saturday, security forces killed three members of the Islamic Jihad militant group who had opened fire during an operation to arrest them near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Now, four Israeli soldiers were wounded, one of them seriously in the operation, police had said. Well, there are fears of escalation. Hamas praised the latest attack. Hamas congratulates the heroic operation that took place this evening. They're quoted in saying, in the middle of so-called Tel Aviv, which led to the killing of a number of occupying soldiers and Zionist settlers, it said in a statement. It is a natural response to defense of our people and our sanctity and sanctuary, they said. And there was also praise from the Gaza-based Islamic Jihad. One of its leaders, Yusuf al-Hassena, said, quote, it confirms that the resistance can penetrate the security system and that the resistance will continue and that it is the best choice to deter the arrogant enemy, end quote. The Tel Aviv attack also came with Israeli police on alert for the first Friday prayers of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the annexed East Jerusalem. So the third holiest site in Islam, it is a flashpoint in the long-running Middle East conflict and a scene of frequent clashes. Last year, nightly demonstrations in Jerusalem, and the Al-Aqsa compound escalated into 11 days of war between Israel and Hamas. So that's the story. Unbelievable. Well, that's where we are today. I hope you'll join us on Monday. Have a wonderful week, weekend. I think the weather's changing, so thank goodness for that. We have a little bit of sun today. I don't know if it's going to clear tomorrow. But whatever the case is, just take care of one another, and I guess that's about it. So have a great weekend, and thanks for being with us today. And of course, thank you to New York State Assembly Member Nader Sayers, who represents Assembly District 90. Always a pleasure to talking to him, and always a learning experience too. So that's always good. Take care and be well. Goodbye.